Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Long before the local food movement took off, today's guest, Frances Moore LePay, wrote the best-selling book Diet for a Small Planet in 1971. She was only 26 at the time. One of her main arguments was that world hunger was caused by our wasteful, meat-centric diet, a lack of democracy, and a concentration of power in the hands of a few. In the chapter Recipe for a Personal Revolution, she wrote, quote, "Taking ever greater responsibility for our individual life choices could be one way to change us, heightening our power and deepening our insight, which is exactly what we need most if we are ever to get to the roots of our society's problems. Changing the way we eat will not change the world, but it may begin to change us, and then we can be part of that changing world," end quote. It was a groundbreaking book, destroying the myth that the world cannot produce enough food to feed everyone. It was also the first major book to expose the negative social and global environmental consequences of Western meat-centric diets. So where are we four decades later? What has changed? What's better? What's worse? Individual action is very popular, especially here in the Bay Area. But how has that really changed the food system? What is needed to turn personal choice into an organized collective movement to fight hunger and environmental degradation? And how has that translated into policy changes? Joining us to discuss these issues is Frances Moore LePay and her daughter, Anna LePay. Frances Moore LePay is the author of 18 books. Diet for a Small Planet has sold over 3 million copies worldwide. Her most recent book is EcoMind, Changing the Way We Think to Create the World We Want. She's co-founded three organizations, including the Oakland-based think tank Food First, along with Small Planet Institute, an organization that seeks to bring democracy back to life, and the Small Planet Fund, which channels resources to democratic social movements worldwide. Anna LePay is the author of three books, including Diet for a Hot Planet, The Climate Crisis at the End of Your Fork, and What You Can Do About It. She's also a board member of the Rainforest Action Network. And they are both authors of Hope's Edge, The Next Diet for a Small Planet. Frances and Anna will be speaking tonight at the Rainforest Action Network's Revel in the Rainforest event at the California Academy of Sciences in San Francisco. And that event starts at 6:30. Frances Moore LePay joins me in studio. Hi.
Hi.
Welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
And Anna LePay is on the phone. Hi, Anna. Welcome back to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having us.
Great to have both of you. So, Frances, I want to start off with you because it's amazing that you wrote Diet for a Small Planet at the young age of 26.
Right near here, too, right there in the UC Berkeley Library.
Before we started the show, you said you don't get tired of talking about it. But what was it like for you back then? I mean, what sparked this at such a young age?
I was desperate. You know, I was a child of the 60s and had to figure it out. I wanted my life to have meaning. And I started out as a community organizer, and I was in graduate school in community organizing. And at one moment, I just said, wait a minute, if I keep doing this, am I really getting to the root of all this needless suffering in the world? And so I stopped doing anything to try to save the world until I knew why I was doing one thing instead of something else. And so I started this journey. But very soon in that food, I thought, gosh, you know, if I just follow the food, if you will, you know, it's so basic. Everybody needs it. Everybody loves to talk about it. Everybody eats. So if I understood why is there hunger in the world, then that would begin to unravel the economic and political questions. And at the time, just as now, we were being told everywhere, we're running out of food, scarcity, famine's inevitable. And I said, really? Is that really true? And I wanted to know. And so I literally started putting the two and two together, you know, and realized, no, we are actively creating the experience of scarcity and scarcity for the future, certainly, by the way we are producing and distributing food. So it was the big, you know, that was what I had to tell people. I had to tell people. And I started out with a one-page handout I was going to post around Berkeley. And then it got into the hands of founders of paperback publishing in America. So the rest, you know, as the cliche goes, is history, because that gave me the platform.
And it's sold 3 million books since then.
It has, yeah.
You have a great story about the publishers and how they learned about your book.
Well, as I say, I had never written anything.
Anything.
I mean, not a letter to the editor, nothing. So I didn't think I was writing a book. I just wanted to know the facts to orient my life. But I did want to share with people. So I started first a handout, then a booklet. And through my then husband, Mark LePay, who had connections, a brilliant scientist and ecologist, he got the book into the hands of Betty and Ian Ballantyne, who were the founders of paperback publishing in this country, and they believed in ideas. And they flew out and said, we want to publish your book. And I said, what? And so I just got to see Betty again. She's in her 80s now, and I had to go see her. So last December, I took her roses, and I said, Betty, I just want you to know that without you, you know, my life would have been a different story. And I said, how did you think I could do this? I had never published. She said, well, she said, it was your idea. She said, I figured I could write if you couldn't. So I laugh now and think, you know, how many publishers would be saying that, but very fortunate.
You know, when you talk about the conversation that was taking place in this country about hunger back then, it reminds me of this really great documentary, A Place at the Table, which looks at hunger in the U.S. today, 48 million people on food stamps. And I loved it because it looked at history and it looked at the 60 Minutes piece that exposed hunger in the United States in the late 60s, I believe.
Yes.
When people were outraged and couldn't believe that was happening.
Yes.
So what was the initial reaction when your book was published? Because at one point we almost did eradicate hunger based on government policies.
Yes. This is the whole myth about the war on poverty, of course, is that it was very effective. We cut the rate of poverty in half and cut hunger drastically. Yes, I mean, that was an era where, of course, there was a war. People were deeply concerned and believed that we could eradicate poverty. And, of course, that was the period also of the, you know, the Peace Corps and all of that came out of that era. And there was a world hunger movement that I soon became part of. And It's so different today. It's very different today. And I'm not sure all the reasons why, but when people say, well, is it better or worse? To me, it is both. It is, you know, it's both better and worse. And in very strong ways, it's both better and worse. And
what would you say are the major changes since then? Let's talk about maybe the positive changes
first. Okay, well, the positive changes, it's phenomenal how much we now know about what it takes to grow healthy food and to eat healthfully. And there's this whole knowledge now of the application of ecological science to agriculture, building on traditional knowledge. And so there's a whole field of agroecology that is spreading throughout the world. And even UN agencies such as the Farmer Field Schools in Asia have trained 2 million farmers in these technologies. Basically, they don't require purchased inputs, but new and better practices. And so I think of it as independence agriculture too, because you're not dependent on the oligopolies that are in control of the commercial seeds and fertilizers and pesticides. So it's a way of farming that is more democratic and actually it helps eliminate poverty itself. So that whole phenomenon and the proof that it works is in now. It is solid.
And you write a lot about this because you and Anna travel extensively, and you've written about your surprise at the innovation you've seen from farmers in places that we might not expect. Can
Absolutely.
You talk about that, and what can we learn from that?
Well, one of my most moving moments was just exactly a year ago. I was in southern India with women who 20 years ago had just the poorest of the poor, lived in fear and humiliation. They had to work as day laborers. They were often beaten by their husbands, bullied by the landlords. And in 20 years, they have moved to absolute food security through their own initiatives, through intercropping, so that in one field I walked through of an acre, there were 20 different nutritious crops and all the things you need, you know, the millets, which are much more nutritious than rice, the oil seeds, legumes, that is the lentils, the greens and medicinal crops as well. They work together every week. These women get together at 9 in the evening after their kids are asleep, and they plan what they're going to do. And they now have their own marketing cooperative and food processing, and they have their own radio station.
Oh, wow.
And the contrast between the way they described their life, they said it was so dark. It was so dark before. We only had one sari. We could never even take off our clothes to wash them. We had to just wash a piece of it at the time, and it was a shame. And now they were beaming, just beaming with pride. And I said, are you worried about climate change? And they said, we know our seeds. These are our seeds. And we are ourselves breeders as we select the best in the fields. And so we know what to do when the rains fail. And so, no, we're not worried about climate change because we know what to do.
What have you seen in the United States that's exciting you?
Well, in the United States, as I'm sure you know, many of our listeners here would know. I mean, the home food movement didn't exist, you know, back then, and that it was just getting started, let's say. And for example, the home food co-op movement, which is now in a burst again, as it was in the 70s of taking off. But you know, organic agriculture was, you know, was really not known. It was very hard to get plant-centered meals. And so that whole phenomenon of community-supported agriculture, of the community garden phenomenon taking off, this is beyond anything I could have imagined then. So all of that, it gives me tremendous hope.
This was really the first book to not only destroy the myth that the world cannot produce enough food to feed everyone, but it was also the first major book to expose the negative social and global environmental consequences of Western meat-centric diets, right? In fact, on the top of the book, it said meat. I just had the photo up. I need to grab it again. Meatless, plant-based recipes?
You know, I tell you the truth.
I'll find it.
I thought it said something about protein, but in any case, I just glad you said that, because I want to make clear that I see this absolutely unsustainable and unhealthy concentration on grain-centered meat as a product, as a symptom of this underlying dynamic that is concentrating wealth and power in our societies, in so many societies. Because the way I try to explain it in Diet for a Small Planet is that, let me just give you a fact that I think is a shocker. Mm-hmm. Only 43% of grain produced in the world today actually goes directly to people. I mean, really. Mm. And, of course, grain is about half of the calories that sustain the planet, and only 43% go directly. Why is that? Because people who, you know, need and want to eat a plant-centered diet, they don't have the economic wherewithal to make that demand. So that grain is then artificially cheap and said, oh, let's turn it into a raw material to produce something, grain-fed meat, that's going to make me more profit. And then wealth accrues to wealth until we have this division, so that today, this is another really shocking statistic to me, 1/4 of all children in the world are stunted, which is a lifelong impairment, 1 in 4, while we have, you know, other people hooked, and really it's I think a strongly, I won't go into that right now, but, you know, really more and more of a meat-centered diet, which is hurting them from another point of view of all the heart and diabetes and other issues that come from eating that grain-fed meat-centered diet. So it makes no nutritional sense for the world. It doesn't ultimately make us feel good and enjoy life. So it is, to me, a product of an economic system that is totally unnecessary. We can make the market work. We don't have to, you know, markets are fine if they serve our values, and we know how to do that. And Brazil is a really interesting example. Maybe we could get to later.
Yeah, so I found the logo of your book from 1971, High Protein Meatless Cooking.
Okay, I thought protein was in there.
But that was pretty edgy back then, right?
Because
how did people respond to that?
Well, people didn't think you could survive without meat. Mm-hmm. I grew up in Fort Worth, Texas, cowtown, you know, and the idea of living without meat was unthinkable. So, yeah, that was their pitch, the Ballantine's idea.
And Anna LaPay, you were born just a couple years after your mom published Diet for a Small Planet. What memories do you have of just the effect that this book had, considering the fact that it sold 3 million copies?
Right. Well, there's the effect very personally on my life, which was I was definitely the test child of the Diet for a Small Planet lifestyle and diet. And I joke with my friends that the junkiest thing we had in our kitchen was rice cakes and peanut butter, and on a good day, maybe some honey or molasses. But, you know, for me, I think it's hard to know what it would be like to grow up in any other life except the one I had growing up sort of in the heart of the work that my mom was doing, and of being right there on the front lines with her in the Institute for Food and Development Policy really early on. So I definitely have that vantage point, and I feel like what I have seen is very much what my mother was describing about this, the positive movements that have emerged in the last, say, four decades, and really kind of seeing that emerge. And so what I grew up with, which might have seemed kind of fringe or odd, that you could really be healthy and thrive without relying on that meat-centered diet, becoming more of an accepted nutritional wisdom, understanding that you can get really good proteins without relying on meat, and also really a growing understanding of the messages that my mother was putting out 40 years ago. I mean, when she tells me stories about back then, just how heretical it was to dare to suggest that we could feed the world with the food that we are currently producing. And I feel like while that's still a myth that we are fighting against, I feel like it is something that more and more people understand, and it resonates with them. And yes, there are still, you know, very strong forces that are trying to fight back against the messages we're getting out there. But I do feel like there's growing awareness of exactly what she was saying 40 years ago.
That is Anna LaPay. She is the author of three books, Diet for a Hot Planet, including Diet for a Hot Planet. She also uses videos to get the messages out, and we'll talk about that later in the show. Frances Moore LaPay is the author of 18 books, including the groundbreaking Diet for a Small Planet, published in 1971 when she was just 26 years old, hadn't written anything up until that point, which I think is really empowering for women, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, Mom, didn't you tell me you got a C on your first college English paper?
So. D, honey, D.
I find that empowering.
Yeah, I love to tell students that. So the last thing I thought I would become is an author. Yeah.
Frances and Anna will be speaking tonight at the Rainforest Action Network's Revel in the Rainforest event at the California Academy of Sciences in San Francisco. It starts at 6:30, and you can find ticket information on our website, yourcallradio.org. And we'd love to hear from you. If you read Diet for a Small Planet in 1971 or recently, what really stood out for you? And how did that shape the way you look at the food movement? And how did that shape the way you make choices about what you eat? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. What food issues concern you today? Who is doing innovative work to change our global food system? And what are examples of some activism that maybe you've been involved in that have made a difference? 866-798-8255. And what do you think is most effective when it comes to really taking on the very small number of multinationals that control our food system? You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. And Anna, I wonder also, because you were just a couple years old when your mom wrote this book and you grew up thinking about these ideas and, you know, talking about politics and just how things work. How did that really shape your views of what it will take to create real change?
That's a good question. I mean, I think that growing up in the family that I did, and as my mom mentioned, my father, Mark LaPay, he was a toxicologist and medical ethicist and did a lot of work on working with communities that were exposed to and affected by chemicals, whether it was farm workers in the fields or workers in factories. And seeing the work that they were doing and their colleagues were doing, I think I was just sort of raised with this understanding that it's okay and encouraged to ask questions and to ask why is the world a certain way and why can't it be different, and to understand that the kind of change that we want to make, it's not something that's going to happen overnight. I mean, my mom and I often joke, sometimes we do speeches together and we kind of look at each other and we think, oh, we've been saying the same thing for 10 years or 40 years or, you know, but to understand that the work that we are, the changes that we're trying to make are multi-generational, and that should not disempower us or make us feel like we shouldn't try to make those changes, but instead should make us feel like ever more that we need to work together, and especially across generations. So that's you know, I feel like it sort of imbued me with that approach to how I think about what I want to do with my life and who I want to surround myself with and what organizations I want to lend my weight, put my weight behind.
And, you know, Anna, I think, and Rose, I think that one of the things that I love about what we're part of is that, yes, we have a very strong critique of the dominant oligopoly-controlled, you know, food system. And so in that sense, it's oppositional. But the beautiful thing about the food movement and everything that we're doing, it's very positive. It is fighting fear, because the biotech industry and other aspects of the problem industries are scare us and say there is no other way. You know, without our technology, you're going to die of starvation. So we can say, no, take a deep breath. There's, as we align with laws of nature, hey, there's more than enough for all of us, as those women in India were living and breathing. And so our message can help reduce the fear. You know, fear creates a brain fog. Mm-hmm. You can't think straight. And I see Anna's work, you know, with parents thinking, oh, there's nothing I can do. My kids are demanding this junk food. I'm afraid, I don't know. And her videos and her messaging showing that there is a way, and reducing parents' fear. So I think that's a key part of the food movement. It is so positive.
Well, let's take a few callers before we go to break. Let's hear from Ruth Ann in El Cerrito. Hi, Ruth Ann. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. I wanted to thank Frances Moore LaPay, because I read her book, Diet for a Small Planet, God, 40 years ago, and it prompted me to go vegetarian.
Yay.
This is a personal thank you. But also the comment that I'd learned since then of how much meat production and big agriculture is contributing to global warming way
yes.
above and beyond, like when you did the show yesterday on solar and electric vehicles. My sense is that big ag is contributing way more to global warming than if everyone went to electric vehicles. And I wanted to ask what could be done, because I've also read in Jonathan Safran Foer's books, he was commenting on his book Eating Animals, that when he tried to get into Big Ag to take photos, they were all barbed wired, that he couldn't get in. And he said, this is not to keep the animals from escaping, it's to keep people like me out from documenting it. And I wanted to know what could be done, you know, as a citizen, to help either defund or change or get more people off of animal products and the production thereof.
Thank you, Ruth Ann.
Anna, do you want to jump in on Diet for a Hot Planet?
Sure. So that's a really, really great question. And that question of what is the connection between the food we eat and the climate crisis is what I delved into in my latest book, which I really feel like is a continuation of Diet for a Small Planet. And essentially what I discovered, and I was really surprised to discover it, is that the food system, and that includes both meat production, but all food production, including from sort of seed to plate to the food that ends up in landfills, is responsible for about one-third of all greenhouse gas emissions. So it comes from the food we eat. And you're right, Ruth Ann, that if you look at the food system, it is more, it is attributable to more greenhouse gas emissions than all transportation combined. And there are a couple main reasons why, and one of them is because of that grain-fed meat diet, that industrial livestock production is so energy-intensive to get to human beings relatively few calories.
And but also, Anna, hold that thought. I'm sorry to cut you off, but we're going to take a quick break, and we'll continue this right after the break. We're talking today with Frances Moore LaPay and her daughter, Anna LaPay, and we're talking about what it will take to change the global food system. We'll be back after this.
You're listening to Your Call on Local Public Radio. If you have a perspective that you haven't heard yet in today's discussion, or you have a question you feel needs to be answered, please get in touch. Call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. You can also email your question or comment to feedback@yourcallradio.org.
The This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll be speaking with some of the Broward Youth Award winners about what we can learn from the next generation of environmental activists. I hope you can tune in for that. It's such an inspiring show. And then on Tuesday night, if you're in the Bay Area or if you can make it here, the Broward Youth Awards ceremony will be taking place. It's a free event, and you can find more information at the Earth Island Institute's website. That's tomorrow, and then on Friday, it's our media roundtable. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are speaking with Frances Moore LePay. She's the author of 18 books, including the best-selling Diet for a Small Planet, published back in 1971 when she was just 26 years old. Anna LePay, her daughter, is the author of three books, including Diet for a Hot Planet, The Climate Crisis at the End of Your Fork, and What You Can Do About It. And they wrote a book together. And this book is called Hope, and you can find more
information.
Hope's Edge. You can find more information about it at yourcallradio.org. You were on the show.
Right.
We were a while back talking about that.
Very early, maybe the first interview we did about our travels around the world.
That was my first radio interview ever.
Ever. That's great.
Yeah.
Frances and Anna will be speaking tonight at the Rainforest Action Network's Revel in the Rainforest event at the California Academy of Sciences in San Francisco. It starts at 6:30, and you can find more information at yourcallradio.org. And if you'd like to join us, if you read Diet for a Small Planet or any of their books, how did it affect you and your food choices? And how has the overall food movement shaped your life and decisions? And later in the show, we'll talk about individual action, collective action, and then what it will take to actually change policy. So if you have any comments on that, we'd love to hear from you. And we just got full lines, but we'll have one open in a few minutes at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. or leave a comment on our website. So before the break, Ruth Ann was talking about the connection between the consumption of animals, which has really gone up drastically since you wrote your book in 1971, and the effects on the environment. And, I mean, the UN comes out with these staggering facts on a regular basis. More than 260 million acres of U.S. forest have been cleared to create cropland to grow grain to feed farmed animals. Raising animals for food uses a staggering 30% of the Earth's land mass. Yeah. And Anna, when you were doing research for your book, Diet for a Hot Planet, what else really surprised you?
Well, a couple things. Number one, I think, is what you just described, Rose, is so true. And what we know is that that's actually a trend that's only continuing. So there's been an increasing demand on grain-fed meat from China, for instance. And so a lot more forest, and especially really important to climate change, rainforest in Brazil is being destroyed to create plantations to grow feed for livestock. So number one, it's a trend that is not just one that we're watching and concerned about. It's one that's increasing and growing concern. The second thing I discovered, which I really didn't know about before at all, is the connection between palm oil production and climate change. So palm oil is the most widely traded vegetable oil in the world. It's grown in production by 400% or more in the past 10 years. It is found in pretty much every snack food product in the supermarket in the United States. But most of us don't realize we're eating it. And the concern about palm oil is it's primarily grown in just two countries, Indonesia and Malaysia, where, especially in Indonesia, it's being grown on land that was former rainforest or former carbon-rich peatland. And as a result of palm oil production, Indonesia has really raced to the top in terms of global greenhouse gas emissions. The country is now the third largest emitter of greenhouse gases. So palm oil was not really front of my mind before writing this book when I thought about global warming, and now it is. It is front of my mind as one of the things that we need to really address and really push for responsible palm oil production if we're going to get on the right side of the climate crisis.
And there's a great website, saynotopalmoil.com, and according to this site, an area the size of 300 football fields of rainforest is cleared every hour in Indonesia and Malaysia to make way for palm oil. That's 6 football fields destroyed every minute. 90% of their habitat is already destroyed, critically endangering orangutans in these areas.
That's right.
I think Anyone listening, if who shares our passion about this, Rainforest Action Network is very, very strong in its campaign on this and showing tremendous leadership. So Rainforest Action Network's website would be a great place to start.
And again, talk about just the power of getting this information out, because a couple Brower Youth Award winners a few years ago, two really amazing young women, took on palm oil, and they got the Girl Scouts, for example, to take palm oil out of the cookies, which is huge because so many boxes of Girl Scout cookies sell.
That's right.
And then they're targeting other, I don't know if we can, junk food or cookie, just or groups that are companies that use palm oil in their food.
Yes. We're calling them at Rainforest Action Network. We're taking on 20 of the biggest snack food companies.
Okay, snack
foods. We didn't want to call them junk food companies because we're trying to work with them. But the idea is that, so palm oil is imported into the U.S. mainly by the agribusiness Cargill. But most of us don't necessarily know when we're buying a Cargill product. So what we did is we looked at what are the 20 biggest snack food companies that purchase that palm oil from Cargill, and how can we work with them to, number one, alert them about the problem with their palm oil, and number two, work with them to put pressure on Cargill and other big importers and other big palm oil traders to really look through their supply chain and come up with ways to really have truly responsible palm oil production.
And again, it's used in everything from crackers to breakfast bars, cake mixes, potato chips.
Yeah, to beauty products, actually. A lot of beauty products have palm oil. It's really, really, really prevalent, shockingly so.
I'm noticing a lot of organic palm oil on labels. Is that any better?
Well, that's a great question. There's also, you might see sustainable palm oil. There's even something called the Round Table for Sustainable Palm Oil. And at the moment, based on our research at Rainforest Action Network, what we're finding is that there's very, very little sustainable palm oil being produced right now. And so what we want to do is to work with producers to develop better protocols to make truly responsible palm oil, but also to reduce the use of palm oil. So part of, you know, when we think about what is sustainable, it's not just how one produces a product, but it's also, of course, how much of something does one use. And right now, the overproduction of palm oil is part of its unsustainability. For instance, one of the reasons why it's used really widely in peanut butter is so that when you open the peanut butter, when you get it from the store, it's already smooth. That's what palm oil does. It helps to bind that peanut butter. Mm. If consumers wouldn't mind sticking their knife in it and stirring the peanut butter, we wouldn't need to have palm oil in peanut butter. So there's a lot of examples like that where we can say, you know what, we don't need palm oil in this product.
And that is Anna LaPay, author of three books, including Diet for a Hot Planet. Frances Moore LaPay is the author of 18 books, including Diet for a Small Planet. And they'll be speaking tonight at the Rainforest Action Network's Revel in the Rainforest event at the California Academy of Sciences in San Francisco. It starts at 6:30. You can find ticket information at yourcallradio.org. And let's go back to calls. Let's hear from Evie in Berkeley. Hi, Evie.
Hi. I read Frances' book in 1971, and I was at home, a mother of three little kids, and I thought, well, what can I do to make this, you know, a positive effect on my family? And it changed the way I fed my family. I never ate swordfish since the day I read that book, and we ate only the small sardines and kippers, and I learned how to make a full protein from rice, beans, and corn. I learned a lot of things out of that book that impacted my very own family, and that's the way I felt I was going to make a change in how things were done. And now my grandchildren are also affected by what I did back then and how I fed my family. Of course, I had the co-op grocery store to assist me in doing that, because they did produce peanut butter that had no palm oil in it. And I met Frances about 3 years ago going around Berkeley again with her new book. And all you have to do is look at her to know that she has led a good life. She was 60 and looked 30, and I'm 80 and look 60. So you know personally that it's going to improve your life, whatever you read out of that book.
Thank you so much. I'm sitting here with a huge grin on my face. But, you know, I think what you're saying is Your response to my book was exactly why I wrote the book. You know, but we all want to feel powerful and meaningful and that our choices do matter. And what I hear you saying is what the excerpt that Rose read earlier from Diet for a Small Planet, that, yeah, my change doesn't change the world. It changes me. And I feel more empowered and more consistent, and I see things more systemically. I see all the ripples that my choices make. So, you know, out of all this, one of my little catchphrases that makes sense to me is that the only choice we don't have is whether to change the world, because every choice we're making is rippling out. So, but when we know that those choices are aligned with the world we want, with a sustainable world and where there's no hunger, that is the best, right? That's just the greatest feeling.
Well, thank you so much for calling in, Evie, and thanks for sharing your story. Let's go next to Esmeralda in San Francisco. Hi, Esmeralda. Hi, are you there? Oh, she dropped. She wanted to talk about the health effects of eating organic since 1968.
Oh, wow. Good for her.
What have we learned about organic food over the past four decades?
Well, I'd love to hear what Anna says. Yeah. One of the things we were really upset about a year or so ago with Stanford's coming out with something that got just heavily quoted, that was kind of dismissing the value. What we do know is that on average, that organic foods are more, you know, produce that has been studied is more nutritious. But we also know that we are exposed to much less chemical pesticides, and that we don't know all the consequences of that, but we do know that there's that everything's connected, and the fewer chemicals that we have in our bodies, the better we are, better off we are. So I think that, but the other thing for me, Rose, is that when people talk about just the value to consumers, that does not include the value to farm workers who are exposed to these deadly chemicals. It doesn't touch the water, the soil issues that happen because of overuse of chemicals. So I think it's not just consumer health that is the advantage of organic eating. It's sending those signals out through the market that we want a healthy planet in general, including our bodies being healthy.
Yeah, just to jump in there, I think that's been one of the things that we know so much more clearly now. There's been this very, very incredible long-term study called the Agricultural Health Study, looking at agricultural workers, farmers, farm workers, and even people just living near farmland. And that the evidence coming out of that study is just pretty profound in terms of the increases chances of Parkinson's disease, of certain forms of cancer, of a range of illnesses that are associated with chemicals used on the field. I thought it was really striking a few years ago when President Obama's cancer panel came out with a really powerful study, and one of the statements in it said, essentially, we encourage people to seek out products that have not been raised with chemicals. And they didn't use the word organic, but if you're trying to find food that has not been grown with chemicals, that is one of the things you would be looking for.
Yeah.
So I think the evidence is really strong.
Yeah, that was a groundbreaking study. We did a show about that.
Oh, great.
Yeah, and we're actually talking about doing another show about cancer and prevention soon. And in the last four decades, we've seen just a massive increase in the amount of pesticides in this country.
We have, and that's something that you often hear kind of folks in the kind of pro chemical world say, no, you know, we're using these more efficiently or we're using fewer, but we are using a huge amount of chemicals. And also, what you find is, again, sort of how people can shape a story depending on how they tell that story, where you often hear the amount of chemicals being used quantified by the pounds, how many pounds of chemicals. But what's really more concerning is the toxicity. So what we know is actually that a lot of the chemicals we're using have higher levels of toxicity, which is, of course, the concern. And so we, as much as organic farming has grown in the past 40 years, you're absolutely right, Rose. We've also seen an increase in pesticides used on the fields, and not just in this country, but around the world.
Well, we've got Esmeralda back. Hi, Esmeralda.
Hi, thank you so much. And thank you to all the callers, and especially Frances, thank you so much for writing this book. I started eating organically at age 18 because of the man I married. I was married at 18. 26 wasn't as young as it is now. I already had two kids when her book came out. I'd had them both at home. I'd nursed them both, and it was so validating because there wasn't a Whole Foods on every corner. You had to go to, like, some really strange little, like, health nut store, they used to call them. But anyway, I'm 65 now. I have two children in their 40s who have been raised without sugar, without processed food, who are in really good shape, never had teeth problems, never had any kind of physical problem, and now grandchildren that are being raised in the same way. I just wanted to say that I have a lot of women friends my age that people say, well, God, you spend so much money on food and organic food so expensive. And I say, well, it's not as expensive as health costs.
Exactly.
I'd rather pay $5, you know, for the organic raspberries or apples or whatever than, actually, I'd rather grow it all, but then pay for doctors who I've never had to go to at 65. I'm not on anything. I feel great. But I think that sense, and I'm sure this is a whole other show too, but just the idea that food should be the cheapest thing, and I always think food should be the most expensive thing that we buy if it's made with organic seeds and organic that won't hurt our bodies so that we don't have to go to the doctor.
Well, but I mean, the other challenge is that it's not available to everyone. I mean, you especially have neighborhoods like West Oakland, for example, used to be a food desert before they got this great co-op, the Mandela Co-op. And the only option people had were the liquor stores, and some of them offered produce, but it's still really hard to get.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it's not accessible to a lot of people.
Well, and the thing that I think people don't understand, too, is that when you look at what's happened, we're talking about trends over 40 years, and one of the big trends, of course, has been the growing inequality in our economy and mm-hmm. what's happened to the typical average worker's wage over these 40 years. And when you look at who has been most impacted by the fact that we haven't seen wages improving for kind of that lowest economic level, what you see is that food sector workers are some of the most underpaid, not to mention exploited workers in our economy. And the irony is that when you look at so many of the diet-related diseases and food insecurity, those are hurting food workers the most.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I think about what are the sort of systemic solutions we're all working for together, it's about raising the wages of food workers so that they can have the ability to feed themselves the food that's really going to nourish them. And so to me, in my mother and I, the work that we do, it's also working with groups like Food Chain Workers Alliance and groups that are trying to work to expose that inequality and to say that food workers deserve much, much more. It's not, you know, that they are really the ones who are putting the food on our table that's nourishing us, and they deserve to be compensated for it.
Yeah, a new study just came out from UC Berkeley about food workers' reliance on public aid costing taxpayers now $7 billion annually.
Wow. Wow. Yes, fabulous study, exactly.
Wow.
And you look at certain companies, you know, Walmart, for instance, there was a congressional report done a few months ago that found that every single Walmart costs hundreds of thousands of dollars a year in terms of what they're having to cover for their work, what the state's having to cover for social benefit for workers who aren't getting paid enough on the job.
And I wanted to ask both of you just about, you know, individual action versus collective action, and then how that translates into changes at the national level. What are your thoughts on that, Frances? Because there is so much focus right now on individual action.
Yeah. Well, I think that this link for me, anyway, is that as we make our own personal choices and literally feel stronger health-wise and stronger in the sense that I think the more convincing I am to myself, the more convincing I think I can be to other people. So aligning my walk and my talk. So I think, and you know, all of that, and that we then are teachers by the choices we make. You know, I think of the caller. I'm sure she's had ripples out. So I think that individual action should never be underestimated. And we also know that to actually change the underlying rules that have allowed this kind of monopoly power to exist, this is astonishing to me that we, you know, we had reforms that were that we have on paper. We have anti-monopoly, antitrust legislation that has not a structure that has not been enforced, and so that kind of action can only come about through the political process. And so one of my many theme songs, you could say, is that we have to get our democracy back, meaning that we have to, what we have now, I call privately held government, because private interests have so much influence. And so we have to keep clear on that goal of removing the power of private wealth within our political system. There are now 24 lobbyists for each one person that you and I elect to represent us. There are 24 lobbyists out there, and those are just the registered ones. And so I think that to continue to link our food action to this broader political challenge, and one of the things that I'm particularly following is an organization called Represent.us, which has come up with a way strategically we can eliminate the power of private money over our political system without running up against the now Supreme Court majority.
We have an email from a listener who says, I read Diet for a Small Planet in 1971. I have not eaten beef or pork and have maintained a healthy diet since. I'm 81 and I look and act like I'm 60. Yay.
Good.
And her SIG file says, dance now, think later, which I really like. Thank you for the email. And let's go back to our callers. Let's hear from Joseph in San Francisco. Hi, Joseph.
Good morning to all. Thank you very much. Very informative. I'm a 62-year-old living with congestive heart failure, largely from poor eating habits, processed foods, and meat. However, at this particular stage of my life, I've turned that around. I'm eating healthy. I'm taking my medication. My question is, I'd like some comment regarding David Nyberg and his argument centered around the animal industrial complex. And finally, can someone mention something about Monsanto and their mad rush to push GM foods and seeds globally?
And what did you want to know exactly about the David Nyberg and the animal industrial complex? He was just on alternative radio a couple days ago.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
I missed that.
He gave
his point of view, and how valid is it?
He gave an amazing talk, I thought. Are you familiar with his work, Francis?
No. I should be. I just wrote it down.
And then you wanted to talk about GMOs.
Yeah. Well, I can jump in on Monsanto.
Sure.
Which I, you know, one of the things that I really like to remind people when is to kind of get people to remember this history of what the company is and how we got to the place we're at today, which is to remind people that Monsanto is a chemical company and have made their profit from chemicals since they were founded. And the part of the reason why the emergence of genetically modified seeds came about is because the company started seeing that some of its most lucrative patents on some of its pesticides were expiring and going into the public domain. And so they started exploring what would be ways to actually engineer a crop so that you could have the pesticide engineered into the crop, so you would have a proprietary seed that farmers would have to pay not only for the seed but for what Monsanto calls its technology fee, and to really essentially bind the farmer to not just purchasing the seed but then also to purchasing the proprietary pesticide that works with the seed. So this technology at its origin was really a technology for thinking about how to generate profit for a company that was seeing its kind of core profit base shifting. And I want to bring that up when I talk about GMOs, because I think people do hear so much of the other frame, which is that these were engineered to help feed the world, or these are being engineered to help us deal with climate change, or all of these other framing messages we hear about GMOs, as opposed to remembering that these were really created by chemical companies to try to figure out a way to create a new profitable product. And when you look at a company like Monsanto, that's taken on not just
the genetically engineered seed business, but also the traditional seed business, you start seeing a kind of concentration and power over our seeds that I think is really, really concerning, especially when we know the importance of crop diversity in the face of climate change.
You know, one thing I wanted to insert here on... more than anything, I hear people saying, but I hear you, it's concentrated power, it's not good enough, but we need that technology to feed ourselves. We're in trouble without this cutting-edge technology. And let me just say that if you compare the yields of the non-GM corn and canola, say, in Western Europe and the U.S., The non-GMO is doing just as well, thank you very much. That this idea that somehow we're going to get more production, it just hasn't borne out in any general way at all. And, of course, we know that greater production is no solution to ending hunger because we have more than enough now to feed the world, to feed us well, if we use these resources well.
And just to end, we've got about a minute left. Frances, I understand you're going to this year's World Food Prize event, which was just given to three chemical company executives, including Monsanto Executive Vice President Robert Fraley.
Yes.
Do you interact with these executives? And if so, what do you say to them?
Well, I'm speaking as part of a panel the day after they receive this prize. And on our website at Small Planet, and let me just quickly say that we have a fact sheet, a GMO fact sheet about what you should really know. You go to our website, you can find that. And also, we have, if you just remember this, realizetheprize.net. We're asking people to make specific requests to the foundation that gave this award so that this could never happen again.
Because it's called the Alternative Nobel Prize.
Well, it is the biggest prize in food and agriculture. And it's a huge, huge mistake in my view.
And you can read about that at yourcallradio.org. Frances Moore LePay and her daughter Anna LePay will be speaking tonight at a Rainforest Action Network event at the California Academy. It starts at 6:30. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thanks for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. What can we learn from the next generation of young environmental activists? On the next Your Call, we'll speak with the winners of the David Brower Youth Awards, which honors young people for their achievements in the fields of environmental and social justice advocacy. What issues drive young activists today, and what can we learn from them? Who have you seen in your community that has inspired environmental change? Join the conversation and call in with your questions on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.